Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we'll be reading from, or continuing, the chapter, The Dynasties of the Sons of Manu. And so that is Canto 9, Chapter 2. And we'll be reading text 10 through text 14, although text 14 is the one on the board. And that's the one we'll be chanting together. So I'll do the Sanskrit and the translation of text 10, text 11 through 13, and then we'll do text 14 together. So text 10. Evan shaptastu gurunun apratya grinat kritanya jalihi adharayat pratam vira urdva retamuni priyam. And the translation for text 10. When the hero Prashadra was thus cursed by his spiritual master, he accepted the curse with folded hands. Then, having controlled his senses, he took the vow of brahmacharya, which is approved by all great sages. In text 11 through 13, Vasudeve Bhagavati Srivatmani Pare Male Ekantitvam Gato Bhaktya Sarvabhuta Surit Samaha Vimukta Sangha Shantatma Samyataksho Parigraha Yatrichayo Papane Nema Kalpayam Vritim Atmanaham Atmani Atmanam Adhaya Jnana Tripta Samahitaha Vichachara Mahim Etam Jadanda Badhirakritihi. And the translation for texts 11 through 13. Thereafter, Prahladra gained relief from all responsibilities, became peaceful in mind, and established control over all his senses. Being unaffected by material conditions, being pleased with whatever was available by the grace of the Lord to maintain body and soul together, and being equal towards everyone, he gave full attention to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudev, who is the transcendental supersoul, free from material contamination. Thus, Prashadra, fully satisfied in pure knowledge, always keeping his mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, achieved pure devotional service to the Lord and began traveling all over the world without affection for material activities, as if he were deaf, dumb, and blind. In text 14, which is the text on the board. Evam vrito virnam gatva Drishva davagni mutitam Teno payukta karano Brahma prapa param munihi Evam vrito virnam gatva Drishva davagnim utitam Teno payukta kurano Karano Rama prapa param munihi. Evam vritso virnam gatva. Drishtva davagnin utitam. Teno payukta karano. Brahma prapa param munihi. Please chant. Evam brito virnam gatva. Deshvata vagnim utitam. Teno payukta karano. Brahma prapa param munihi. Evam brito varnam gatva. Deshvata vagnim utitam. Teno payukta karano. Brahma prapa param munihi. Evam vritso vinam gatva. Deshvata vagnim utitam. Teno payukta karano. Brahma prapa param munihi. Evam vritso vinam gatva. Deshvata vagnim utitam. Teno payukta karano. Brahma prapa param munihi. Evam vritso vinam gatva. Deshvata vagnim utitam. Teno payukta karano. Brahma prapa param munihi. So the word for word for text 14. Evamvritta. Being situated in such an order of life. Vanam. In the forest. Gatva. After going. Drishtva. When he saw. Dava agnim. A forest fire. Utitam. Existing there. Tena. By that fire. Upayukta karanaha. Engaging all the senses of the body in by burning. Brahma, transcendence. Prapa, he achieved. Param, the ultimate goal. Munihi, as a great saintly person. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. With this attitude, Prashadra became a great saint. And when he entered the forest and saw a blazing forest fire, he took this opportunity to burn his body in the fire. Thus he achieved the transcendental spiritual world. Purport. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 4:9, Janma karma cha me divyam, evam yo veti tatvataha, tyaktva deham punar janma, nam mam eti so arjuna. One who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not upon leaving the body take his birth again in this material world, but attains my eternal abode, O Arjuna. Prashadra, because of his karma, was cursed to take his next birth as a sudra. But because he took to saintly life, specifically concentrating his mind always upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he became a great devotee. Immediately after giving up his body in the fire, he reached the spiritual world, as mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, Mameti, as a result of his devotional situation. Devotional service performed by thinking of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is so powerful that although Prasadra was cursed, he avoided the terrible consequence of becoming a Sudra and instead returned home back to Godhead. As stated in Brahma Samhita 5:54, Yastu Indra Gopam Atavendram Aho Svakarma Bantanurupam Palabhajanam Atanoti Karmani Nirdadahati Kintu Chabhakti Bhajam Govindam Adipurusham Tamaham Bhajami. Those who engage in devotional service are unaffected by the results of their material activities. Otherwise, everyone, from the smallest microbe up to the King of Heaven, Indra, is subject to the laws of karma. A pure devotee, being always engaged in the service of the Lord, is exempt from these laws. Om Gyana Timrandasya Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimata Ramapada Swami Dinamine. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimata Bhaktivedanta Swami Itinamine. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. So here we are. In this particular text, the circumvention of the result of Prasadra's action is highlighted by Srila Prabhupada. So the activity that Prasadra had performed as part of his cow protection had been to take up his sword, and this is quoting from text 9, because the stars were covered by clouds, he mistook the cow for the tiger and immediately cut off the cow's head with great force. So this activity on the part of Prasadra of protecting cows had been part of a vow that he had undertaken to stand all night with a sword in hand in order to provide protection to the cows. So indeed, this particular engagement of being a kshatriya, awarding protection to cows, had been under the order of his spiritual master. Srila Prabhupada, he explains that the inspiration to perform work is the same, whether that inspiration is coming from the scriptures or whether that inspiration is coming from the instruction of the spiritual master. So there's an inspiration, there's the worker, and then there's the actual activity which takes place with the help, of course, of the senses and the mind. And this is a breakdown that is given in the purport in Bhagavad Gita in 1819. So the inspiration or the impetus before one acts, which for Prasadra was that order of his spiritual master to protect the cows. And in fact, he dedicated himself to cow protection as his way of life. He had no dynasty, so it means he wasn't sitting on a throne and ruling subjects, but rather this was the particular role he was taking up in his life, only that service of every night, just standing with a sword in hand on the land where there was a cow shed. So there's also a subtle form of work, which is the solution one reaches before that work is actually accomplished and or actualized. And so for Prashadra, no doubt that related to the usage of his sword. And of course, there's a psychological process where one's processing giving some thought to something. There's some feelings associated with the thought. And of course, there's the willing, the part that's going to allow for that subtle form of work to then manifest in some action. So for Prashadra, the impetus and that psychological process of thinking, feeling, and willing, for him took the form of following the sound of a cow that was screaming in distress and fear, because it had been seized by a tiger. Next, the work component, he took up his sword, and there was just a little difficulty because his work required the ability to see how he was going to use the sword. But at that precise moment, the clouds were completely obscuring the stars, so no light was being shed on the scene. So his work is taking up the sword, and due to the imperfection of eyesight, due to the lack of adequate light, he mistook the cow for the tiger and immediately cut off the cow's head with great force. Now, there's knowledge, there's the object of knowledge, and there's the knower. And these are the three factors that motivate action. Then there's the senses, the work, and the doer, which are the three constituents of action. This is given in Bhagavad Gita 18:19. So, Prashadra's knowledge, which was the impetus for his daily work, was in the mode of goodness, which by definition is the knowledge by which one undivided spiritual nature is seen in all living entities, though they are divided into innumerable forms. So he specifically had made a pledge to protect those living entities that for Krishna are akin to worshipping him. Krishna says this himself. He says, one should worship me within the cows by offering them grass and grains. One should worship, and it's part of a whole long sequence where he's having a conversation with Uddhava, so I've just extracted two parts of it. He says, one should worship, in addition to worshiping me within the cows by offering them grass and grains, one should worship the Vaishnavas as being none different from me by showing them love and respect. So this is his conversation with Uddhava from chapter 5, text 43 to 45. It's rather long, so I've just extracted. So that object of knowledge was the adherence to the order of his spiritual master. And it was in the mode of goodness because there was regulated occupational duty as the Kshatriya protecting the cows. Now, his action, however, that rainy night resulted in the death of a cow, and a cow being mistakenly killed by his own sword. Now, his spiritual master's response was then to curse him. In your next life, you shall not be able to become a Kshatriya. Instead, you shall take birth as a sudra because of killing a cow. So he wouldn't be in a position any longer where he's in that category of society that's giving protection. He would not be allowed to be in that section. That was the curse of his spiritual master. Rather, he'd be in that kind of servitor position to the rest of the members of society. So degrading in terms of the orders of society. Now, according to Manu, the great author of civic codes and religious principles, he specifically says that even the killer of an animal is to be considered a murderer, for the reason that, and this is related to animal food is not meant for a civilized man. So that's the reason that's given why the killing of an animal is puts a person into the category of being a murderer. Means the person's completely uncivilized and is a murderer at the same time. And the second reason that Manu's giving in his codes for why the killer of an animal can be considered a murderer is that actually it's taking one's prime duty is to prepare oneself for going back to Godhead. So naturally, engaging in killing is completely divergent from the path one should be on. So this comes from a purport in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam in the 70th chapter, 37th verse. So no one has the right to kill an animal by independent whims. And naturally, in the case of Prasadra, his senses were controlled. And this is evidenced by the fact that he'd taken a vrata or a vow to perform his occupational duty. In addition, Prasadra was executing an act of violence in order to kill an enemy. So the tiger, according to a principle of religion, falls into the category of being a resistant enemy. I mean, it's not that the tiger was lending himself to being killed by the sword. I mean, we hear that when his ear got in that dark, in the darkness, in that moment when Prasadra raised his sword and severed the cow's head, he'd also, the edge of the sword cut the ear of the tiger, and the tiger fled. So we know it was a resistant creature. It's not that he remained there for further combat. So so this is in accord with the principle of religion. He was attempting to kill a resistant enemy. So there's an injunction. This is a scriptural injunction. A person who knows the principles of religion does not kill an enemy who is, and this is the category, who's careless, intoxicated, insane, asleep, afraid, or devoid of his chariot. Nor does he kill a boy, a woman, a foolish creature, or a surrendered soul. That injunction is again given in the first canto in the 7th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam. And it's spoken by Lord Krishna to Arjuna when Arjuna is dealing with Ashwatthama. Now, Prasadra had, however, unknowingly killed this cow, which is, there's another reason why there's a problem, because a cow is considered beneficial because one draws religious principles from her. So the principle of religion is drawn in the form of milk, the cow's milk, which is used in sacrificial fire through his conversion into ghee. And the performance of such a sacrifice allows for a householder to be happy. So he had, in fact, unknowingly killed a helpless creature. Now, Prasadra, his response to the curse is in line with the mode of goodness that he was operating by. He accepted the curse with folded hands, And then he took a vow, and it was the vow of brahmacharya. Now, there's two types of brahmacharis. One returns home from his spiritual master's ashram and gets married. And the second type of brahmachari takes the vow to remain a brahmachari perpetually. So that's called the brihadvrata. So it's a vow that's taken. So we'll take it that Prashadra took the brihadvrata. So again, he's taking a vow, very controlled senses. And that brahmachari doesn't return from the place of his spiritual master. And that distinction is made, one finds it in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the 9th canto, the 4th chapter. So Prashadra, by taking this particular vow, he was controlling the mind by abstaining from any sense gratification. So, and this is the sacrifice that a brahmachari does. So it's the hearing process, and the senses are put in the fire of mental control. So that's the sacrifice for the brahmachari, given in Bhagavad Gita in 4:26. So hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord, the brahmachari is following the basic principle for understanding Krishna. And Prashadra, Srila Prabhupada tells us, he specifically concentrated his mind upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So basically this means for making the mind austere, it needs to be detached from sense gratification, and it needs to be trained to be very grave in thought. So Prashadra is described as, this comes in the long verse, the 11 through 13 that was read today. He's described as being unaffected by material conditions, and this is the criterion whereby one can know that the mind is being controlled. It's completely unaffected by external material conditions. And there's satisfaction. He's described as being pleased with whatever is available by the grace of the Lord. And this is another criterion that's been met, that he's not expecting any material benefit. So he's meeting the criteria very perfectly for a controlled mind, for adherence to his vow of brahmacharya. So once again, we see that Prashadra is performing austerity. It's very consistent with the earlier part at the time of mistakenly killing the cow. So he's very much in the mode of goodness. And I'm going to read Bhagavad Gita verse 17-18. Shradaya paraya taptam tapas tatri vadham naraha apalayang shibir yuktai satvikam parikakshate. This threefold austerity performed with transcendental faith by men not expecting material benefits but engaged only for the sake of the Supreme is called austerity in the mode of goodness. So this is very much Prashadra. So by this behavior of satisfaction, simplicity, gravity, self-control, and purification of existence, these are all austerities of the mind. And this allowed Prashadra to reach the spiritual world. And because he specifically concentrated his mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so powerful was the effect of his devotion that he was able to circumvent that consequence of having mistakenly killed the cow, and or a very helpless animal, albeit unknowingly, but still he performed the action. So Srila Prabhupada quotes in this text of today, he quotes Sri Brahma Samhita by way of explanation of how this was possible. I mean, apart from, you know, this very mode of goodness behavior of Prashadra. And the verse Srila Prabhupada's quoting is Lord Brahma speaking, where he says, "I adore the primeval Lord Govinda who burns up to their roots all fruitive activities of those who are imbued with devotion and impartiality and obtains for each the enjoyment of the fruits of activities of those who walk in the path of work in accord with the their previously..." I made some mistake. Sorry. The text, "who walk in the path of work in accordance," and then somehow I've typed something incorrectly here. That this applies to even tiny insects who bear the name Indragopa or to that of a king of the devas. So it means that karma ends and one becomes free from all desires save that of serving Krishna. And by moving in that direction, Krishna is responding by destroying karma. And also the desires that are connected with karma. And this is shown here in this example of Prashadra. So those are some thoughts on this verse from today. There's anything to expand our discussion?
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. One comment and then one question. One thing I appreciate about this verse, I mean, there's so many analogies, but this pastime says he didn't even retaliate against his spiritual master. He just accepted with folded hands and all. One analogy that Radhananda Maharaj likes to quote a lot is actually from the Bible. There's a verse where Jesus says, you could build your house on a rock foundation or sand. If you build your house on a rock foundation, then when storms come, then it'll remain standing. And the reason I appreciate that is because a lot of times when we come to spiritual life, we come without a foundation that things should go my way. We don't calculate there's going to be storms even among the devotees, because the tendency is that when you come to spiritual life, that's what Raktat told me. He said when I came to the temple, I thought all my material desires would go away and that all devotees would be, you know, nice and respectful and kind to each other perfectly. Everyone would be perfect. Then he was like, I quickly realized that wasn't true. So what's the question? You have to build a foundation of, you know, these qualities. But my question is kind of related to this point. It says that he didn't retaliate against his spiritual master externally and assuming internally. But that's the tendency, is that when our spiritual master comes, it's probably easy to be tolerant maybe of his criticism, constructive criticism externally and internally, because, you know, if you're thinking negative thoughts about your own spiritual master internally, you will probably leave Krishna consciousness soon. But my question is kind of related with when like Nityananda Prabhu said a few weeks ago, when the teacher leaves the classroom, everyone starts disrespecting each other. Everyone starts bickering. I had that experience in school. I'm sure everyone had that. So how can we develop not like a duplicitous faith in a spiritual master, that when he's here, you know, I'm on my game, and when he's not, you know, I could do whatever I want, think whatever I want about anyone, whatever I want, because only my spiritual master is great, or devotees I like are great. and then we lose our taste for Krishna consciousness. That's the tendency. And can you explain? I don't know if my question was clear, kind of, but maybe you could elaborate on those points a little bit.
So, you were making a or drawing a particular analogy from the Bible where I guess Christ had made the statement that a house built on a rock is going to stand when there's a storm, but one built on sand won't be able to withstand a storm. And then that led you to thinking about the concept one may have that when one comes to take up devotional life or meditation on Krishna, then actually there's the concept or the belief or the expectation that all interrelationship or dealings with other devotees will be of an idyllic nature, like no conflict whatsoever, there'll be perfect behavior, and then somehow other that doesn't prove to be the case, and that led you to reflect that the spiritual master, or the in the presence of the spiritual master, if there's something that is like some criticism that comes, one can tolerate that, which I take by implication means that one may not be so tolerant of criticism coming from fellow devotees. And your question was, in the absence of the spiritual master, how is it that one can function in such a way that one's not walking around holding in one's mind the thought that it's perfectly all right that in the mind one can have ill thoughts of others, or you know, critical thoughts or something of that nature. So, and this is a very pertinent question, taking into account the particular topic of discussion today, because the topic of discussion was control of the mind. So, and you had rightly said that the foundation for being able to stay firm in one's devotion is the cultivation of the particular qualities that were enumerated that Prashadra was displaying: the gravity, the simplicity, the tolerance for external difficult circumstances. And so since you'd brought in the spiritual master, and the spiritual master perhaps pointing out a fault, and saying that, you know, somehow either that was perfectly fine, but it wasn't fine in the mind if that was pointed out by fellow devotees, so, you know, how to manage that. So the the same respectfulness that one has towards one's spiritual master, which is what allows one to tolerate the particular uplifting statement that's made, and one understands it as uplifting, even though some difficulty may be being highlighted by the spiritual master. that same sort of respect can be extended if one sees oneself as representing one's spiritual master in one's dealings with others. So that acts as a kind of break for allowing the mind to take charge in a dealing where some criticism may come one's way, or some fault may be pointed out, where one may think, the immediate response of the mind is, I don't want to tolerate this. I'm going to tolerate this. If one remembers that one is representing one's spiritual master, so always the allegiance to the spiritual master should come into the picture in terms of one's own behavior. Because it reflects on one's spiritual master, one's behavior. So it's very much part of extending that respect one feels for one's spiritual master to continue to externally behave in such a way that it will not reflect poorly on the spiritual master. Because if one is behaving poorly, one could question, oh, is the spiritual master not performing his duty? Has he not instructed the disciple well? So, and naturally, the spiritual master is performing his duty, and it's up to the disciple to always bear in mind that he's a representative of the spiritual master. So one cannot allow oneself to have the mind rule and take over in some dealing with someone. It's always best to step out of the situation if the mind is taking charge, and, you know, wait until one's got control of oneself and, you know, has things in order again. And then, you know, one can more rationally approach someone and say, you know, your particular statement or your particular criticism, I'm having a hard time to accept. And the reason I have a hard time to accept is because I never saw this fault in myself, or, you know, whatever it is. One can have a dialogue, but it has to be in a calm state. It cannot be that one allows the mind to take over. So that break is necessary.
I'm just curious, generally in Vaishnav culture, one doesn't necessarily give up their body voluntarily in the sense of committing suicide. But we see great rishis, they sometimes, of their own volition, give up their body. So just kind of a question in terms of what commits, on what sense is it committed, considered a sin? We know that, you know, the body belongs to the spiritual master. One's not allowed to give up their body. But at the same time, a certain level, a certain caliber of devotees sometimes exhibit that.
So, what's been pointed out here is the a kind of discrepancy that generally the body is considered to belong to the spiritual master, and so one doesn't have a right to commit suicide or give up the body. But here we've seen examples of rishis who actually do so, and in Prashadra's case, he entered a fire and gave up his body. So you were noting this discrepancy. Well, since the body is the vehicle for the soul, and the soul is who one actually is, that vehicle has to be preserved in order to be able to execute one's service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the mind, the intelligence is encased, the subtle body is encased within the grosser body. So the preservation of the grosser body is essential in order to be able to live out one's natural term within the vehicle that's encasing the subtle body. And indeed, at the time of choosing to be under a spiritual master, one is voluntarily submitting one's whole being to the spiritual master. And one is performing the subtle activities, as was exemplified here by Prasadra, of you know, bringing the mind under control. So I think there's an example of a devotee of Srila Prabhupada during Srila Prabhupada's time at that moment, at some, I think, Vishnu Jan Swami. So I haven't read all the specifics, but I understand that there was a thought that this devotee had given up his body. And the reason he'd given up his body was that his mind, I think, may have dwelt for a moment on a female form, and he'd taken such, he was so pure in his devotion that just having that thought meant for him that he should give up his body. So, and Srila Prabhupada's response, from what I recall of hearing it, I haven't specifically read it, is that this was a very advanced devotee. So, so it would indicate that the level of internal purity was such that even a slight impurity in the mind was intolerable. So it was his action was not met with disapproval from Srila Prabhupada. Rather, he was commended for his extreme purity. So the particular rishis who do give up their bodies, such as Prashadra entering a forest fire and giving up his gross body, I guess would be an indication of the extreme level of purity. One is truly not even inhabiting in the fullest sense that gross body. The subtle body is so purified, it's, as in Prashadra's case, it's ready to enter into the spiritual world. So the body is completely spiritualized already. So it's just an action that's performed that truly, that sort of eliminates or burns away. I mean, in his case, it's graphic burning away of the physical body, but the physical body has already been completely purified. So that's how I understand it.
Hare Krishna. I have just a comment, or a few comments about Jai Bhadi's question. You mentioned something about the presence of Guru not being there, and it made me think of Chaitanya Charan Prabhu, the classes he gave. He mentioned that to control the mind, we should focus our intention on something that's greater than the mind. And I was just thinking of, like, if we're in the consciousness of actually having the knowledge of Guru Tattva and the actual kind of internal representation of Guru and external manifestation that is the spiritual master, then we can see that, in one sense, Guru is everywhere, you know, just like the super soul, every particle of every atom. So really there's not, we're never not in the presence of Guru in that sense. So that's just something I was thinking about in terms of not seeing ourselves disconnected just because the physical presence of the Guru isn't with us.
If I may respectfully just look at one statement that you made, which I disagree with. The thought that the spiritual master is the same as the super soul and present everywhere, that it's not completely accurate, because the spiritual master is always the servitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he's not in the position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So super soul is Supreme Personality of Godhead that's present everywhere. He's manifesting in that way, but spiritual master's presence remains in his instruction. So it's actually the instruction being carried on the subtle level that keeps the spiritual master present.
So I'm also going off things that I heard in Nityananda Pran's 24 Gurus class, because you know, he went over, and just I've been reading the book Guru and Disciple, And so in one sense, yeah, he's not. But at the same time, you know, Chintabheda Veda Tattva and all that confusing stuff. But I'm just going off the point of it's the representative. Like there's the one verse in the Mangalarti prayers, Samasya Shastra, that, you know, verse, that he's a representative. And in that case, since he's, you know, you could clearly see that in the 24 gurus portion of the Bhagavatam that he's definitely, you know, getting instructions from guru. But, you know, so it's kind of like it's a contradiction to me. I mean, but I understand the point you're bringing up.
I'm not sure if I understood perfectly. Do you think you can say more simply what you were saying so I can understand perfectly? All right, what I understood, to say that I'm comprehending your line of thought, is that you were referencing one of the morning prayers, that all the revealed scriptures point to the worshipable position of the spiritual master. And then I missed some of the other part of some of the classes that you'd heard, but I take it that you were trying to reinforce that the classes were also pointing to that position of the spiritual master. Is that correct?
I don't have, due to Kali Yuga memory, I don't have the capacity to remember exactly, but I could show you the Guru and Disciple book, and I could show you the verses that kind of confirm, so I'm not, it doesn't seem like I'm speculating, so like it confirms what I'm saying, but I, from my knowledge and what I've been told, there's a simultaneous, you know, oneness with Supersoul, but different being the servant of Supersoul, and kind of a the representative of Supersoul, so not, you know, not being exactly the same, you know, Krishna himself, because even Prabhupada said no, but it should be seen like that, because he's always at the lotus feet of Krishna, and completely, directly, intimately connected with Supersoul.
Ah, I see what you're saying. Okay, so you were just commenting that the spiritual master is the external representation of super soul. Okay. Yes, yeah, so your two comments had been then, if I were to summarize it, that there's the worshipable position of the spiritual master is given in all the revealed scriptures, that he's worshipable. And the second point that you'd highlighted is that the spiritual master is the external representation of Supersoul. So, yes, these are part of expanding one's understanding of, I guess, the significance of an instruction received from the spiritual master, which was a point that Jai Baladev had brought up and that led to your two comments. So, indeed, the spiritual master is in that confidential position in his serving Lord Krishna, that he is accessing instructions from the super soul. It's a level of purity. So, generally, one is not at that level of purity that one knows Krishna's directions directly, so they're received by the spiritual master. And further indications may be there of what the correct course of action is at any time, but confirmation is needed from spiritual master, the scriptures, the devotees. Everything needs to work harmoniously together. And So The spiritual master does, however, occupy that very unique position, which was your comment, that his particular instructions are directly the instructions of Super Soul. So, you know, by implication, one can take it that a devotee in a very purified state is acting in complete accord with Krishna's desires. There's no discrepancy whatsoever. So, yeah, that's rather extraordinary, actually. Thank you for your contribution.
So just real quick, just so you know my train of thought, I was also going off of, like, there was a point we read in the Matsya incarnation pastime of the prayers that King Satravata gave of saying that the Supreme Personality of God is the original spiritual master. And I've heard, you know, many, many places that Lord Balaram is the original spiritual master. And we also hear that Guru is one. So, you know, very confusing stuff that I was just basing it off of.
So you're expressing some confusion because there's the statement that Lord Balaram is the original spiritual master, Krishna is the original spiritual master, and then there's some confusion because there's the statement that Guru is one. if one were to take it that a statement such as Guru is one, I don't know where it's drawn from, so it would be necessary to find the reference before commenting on that, but one can certainly say the Guru is the confidential servitor of Krishna. All the revealed scriptures point to that, and he's to be accepted as such. So that we can take as a truth.
The term Guru Tattva refers to, you know, the oneness of Guru. So, you know, Krishna as the original Guru, Lord Balaram as, you know, the one who is expansion of Krishna that have to do with teaching or being in charge of the knowledge actually how to serve Krishna. So now, that being said, that oneness, obviously, as you responded, is the spiritual master, one spiritual master, physical spiritual master, the connection that we have to the parampara. That person represents that Lord Balaram, that Guru Tattva, and receive, as you pointed out, in your response, that the instructions come through the spiritual master. Now, the idea of there are many, you know, there's 24 gurus, and actually one can receive instructions, the instruction from this, from the Cheta Guru, the super soul, which are represented by your physical spiritual master, you can actually find it, you know, it can come. But how it comes is when the disciple is extremely connected to the instructions of the spiritual master, exactly as you responded, which, you know, I fully agree. That only when you are fully connected to the instructions of your spiritual master, then, you know, a frog you've seen doing something, you know, this confirms or reminds me or make me connect to the instruction that my spiritual master gave me, X instructions like that. So my spiritual master is talking to me through this thing. So like that, the example of Viva Mangala Thakur, that he was reminded of the knowledge that he had by a prostitute. So he considered the prostitute one of his gurus. But, you know, the principle is that one has to have very, very much connection to the relationship and instructions with your own spiritual master that represents the instructions of the super soul. Without that connection, then you're not able to recognize. You're just, you know, rationalizing, or your mind is taking up. So one have to have a very strong connection with your spiritual master and take the instructions. And then, you know, the spiritual master will communicate in many ways, through another devotee, through nature, to something like that. So that's an understanding.
Thank you very much for particularly highlighting that it's the strength of the connection with the spiritual master that then might allow one to, and this was the part that I hadn't understood of the comment, might allow one to see even other entities or other signs in nature that reinforce or allow one to see that the spiritual master is talking to one. Again, it indicates that level of purity that one is not having any discrepancy between the instruction of the spiritual master and one's being, one's functioning. Everything is seen through the light of the instruction of the spiritual master. So it's a consciousness that isn't deviated from being the focus on the instruction. So, yeah. Thank you very much for expanding on that. Jai Baladev? Yes, it's fine. It's fine. We've got about 2 minutes.
Okay. I get accused of going long, but it's like 5 hours. I have a more light question. I see the comedy in the scriptures, but my question is related to, you mentioned that we shouldn't do anything to embarrass the guru. Naturally, and I think that's a good point. But one thing I appreciate about one pastime missing in my Anchalila is called Pradyumna Mishra takes instructions from Ramananda Roy, and in that pastime, Lord Chaitanya asked Pradyumna Mishra to take instructions from Ramananda Roy. Long story short, he went to Ramananda Roy's temple, and he saw some questionable activities. And those questionable activities was Ramananda Roy was choreographing some dance for some beautiful women. Not only that, he massaged their naked bodies with oil. And then he came back to Lord Chaitanya and said, "You sure you want I should hear from him?" And Lord Chaitanya says, "Yes." It's a long story, but basically Lord Chaitanya says, "I already know he does that." It's a good pastime. But he mentions that his consciousness is not lusty. He's actually thinking of himself as the maidservant of the gopis in the spiritual world. So my question is related to that point is that a lot of times we're not massaging women with oil, naked women in the temple. And so whatever fault somebody may say, they may say, I'll use this example, somebody's talking too long in class, but we can see that everybody does it. So sometimes people are singled out, and then we see word gets to the spiritual master. So my understanding is that maybe you could relate one point that Prabhupada mentioned in the Krishna book. In chapter 50, he mentioned it recently. It's a point I mention all the time. He was mentioning that demons always see their enemy's fault. They never see the faults of their self or their friends and family. And that's a tendency. We're not massaging women in the temple. But what are this tendency? We have people are overenthusiastic about Krishna consciousness, and they may be labeled as proud. That's the tendency. So the tendency that may get to the spiritual master, but that's something we can't control. So my question is that it doesn't matter what you do, somebody will always find fault. Just like Haridasa Thakur, he was a perfect devotee, but Ramachandra Khan found fault. So how do we get past the tendencies that I should be perfect so nobody tell my spiritual master. But it doesn't matter what you do, somebody will find fault, because we're all prisoners. That means if you're in a prison, that means there's going to be some conflict and somebody will find fault. So how do we give up this tendency to be like a tattletale about little small things? We're not massaging women in the temple with oil. So these are small little bickering, like,
so tattletales. The question is, taking into account the difficulty of being perfect, how is it that one, I don't know if it was prevents others from tattletaling to the spiritual master about one's imperfections? Well, one has no control over the behavior of others. But one can certainly manage oneself. And the way one manages oneself always is adhering very strongly to any instruction that's come from the spiritual master, because the one instruction is very deep and it can take a whole lifetime of meditation, refining one's adherence to it. So one refines and refines and meditates more deeply on it. And even if it appears like a simple instruction, over time one sees the implication for one's mind, one sees the implication for one's emotions, one sees the implication for one's external behavior. So one instruction can purify one's entire life. So keeping one's focus on that instruction will take one's focus away from, you know, what the external stuff is that's happening. And again, one cannot control anybody else's behavior, but by virtue of the fact that one's adhering so closely and meditating so deeply on one's spiritual master's instruction will keep one safe and very much respected by everybody else, because it becomes apparent when somebody is adhering very closely to a spiritual master's instruction, so apparent, and it automatically brings respect and all the honor that one could possibly want. But one doesn't even need that honor, because the happiness lies in following the spiritual master's instruction. It's a source of great happiness and security and contentment and safety. Safety. So thank you very much. Jai Prabhupada Ki Jai.